The Gist is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com and enter offer code GIST, that's G-I-S-T, at checkout. A better web starts with your website. The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Tuesday, June 3rd, 2014. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Today we will be talking to a musician who founded an institution called the Loser's Lounge. You'll hear some Talking Heads covers. And in the spiel, a shaggy dog story. Actually, it'll be a shaggy hog story. And up top, we will be discussing rhetoric that is so filled with qualifiers and even-handedness that it fails to rouse. That was what was said about President Obama's recent speech at West Point. And it's true, it's hard to find middle ground and also get people all fired up. I mean, if Henry V, before the Battle of Agincourt, wanted to stir the English, but also wanted to allow for the many qualifiers and to fairly note the prudent middle course, maybe the speech wouldn't have gone as well. In fact, it probably would have gone something like this.
This day is called the Feast of Crispian.
Well, that's of course according to the Georgian calendar and depending on your time zone.
He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when the day is named,
but possibly also experience some post-traumatic effects from the fight. I would not want to minimize that.
He that shall live on this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is Saint Crispian.
Unless, of course, the neighbors are of a different faith, they might not celebrate Saint Crispian, in which case I recommend that you be sensitive to their cultures.
Then he will strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispian Day.
Though also note that for all our advances in poultice and ointments, a statistic significant subset of you will not have your scars here so well.
From this day to the end of the world,
because climate change, hello,
but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, from he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother.
Though not in a strict you can ascend the throne sort of way, all right, it's a simile,
shall think themselves accursed that they were not here and hold their manhoods cheap while any speak that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day.
So this might be the white male privilege talking, but huzzah! And transitioning to our current leader of America. President Obama is in Europe for the next few days. Tomorrow, he'll meet the new president of Ukraine. Today in Poland, he sought to lower the temperature of U.S.-Russia relations.
We are interested in good relations with Russia. We are not interested in threatening Russia. We recognize that Russia has legitimate interests in what happens along its borders and has a long historic relationship with Ukraine.
This is what Obama does. It's who he is. Last week at West Point, he gave a speech in which he spoke of what America's role in the world will be.
In fact, by most measures, America has rarely been stronger relative to the rest of the world. Those who argue otherwise, who suggest that America is in decline or has seen its global leadership slip away, are either misreading history or engaged in partisan politics.
So I count four qualifiers in that passage. And that's one reason why even pundits who agree with the restraint and temperance shown in the speech called it flat or passionless or not forward-looking. It does seem like a big rhetorical lift to rouse with a message of caution. Also, might not good policy sometimes make for blah phrases? Joining me now is Hendrik Hertzberg, who worked as a speechwriter during the Carter administration. That administration occasioned an Atlantic magazine cover story on the passionless presidency, by the way. Rick is now a senior editor with New York Magazine. Thanks for coming on, Rick.
Hi.
So, of course, it's hard to rally round restraint, but is it not impossible to craft a rhetoric that argues that point of view with some vim?
You can certainly write it. Whether you can write it as a presidential speech is another matter. There's a kind of inherent contradiction between rousingness and restraint.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really why you asked the question.
Maybe the better question is, how important is it to be rousing at all times? I'd rather have right decisions than soaring rhetoric, rhetoric that soars into, you know, where a smoking gun becomes a mushroom cloud. That's a great line. Took us to a bad place.
Yeah, well, rhetoric can't always be soaring. There can't only be one mood all the time. Soaringness is appropriate for some things, and down-to-earthness is appropriate for others, and calm is appropriate to still others. Obama chose to make this speech at West Point, and it was kind of inevitable that he was going to on the restrained and quiet side. The graduates that he was addressing are the first graduating class from West Point in quite some time, who will not be going into combat, probably. And certainly if Obama has anything to say about it, they won't be going into combat. In a funny way, if you look at it from the point of view of those cadets and of the Army in general, that's going to mean fewer promotion opportunities for them. I mean, it means that they're going into a profession that's going to be restrained as well.
Right.
Now, there's a presidential speech always has more than one audience, and obviously the audience for this one is global and on many, many levels.
So what do you think of the speech itself?
I thought it was a good speech. I thought it was right for the occasion in a kind of a bank shot sort of way.
All right. Now, let me play. I'm going to play now a David Brooks clip from the NewsHour. And Brooks mostly agreed with what was in Obama's speech, at least the policy that animated the speech. But he did have his critiques. And here's a critique.
I would say the lesson in the 1920s and 1930s is that there's also a problem of underreach. And I think the president underestimates that. And I would say for the past 70 years of American foreign policy, we understood we had a responsibility to keep a global world order.
So I wanted to put that forward because that's a reasonable critique. I mean, we could quote from a, you know, very fiery critic, and then we'd get all caught up in criticizing the critic. But let's talk about Brooks's point. What if the ambitions for Obama's speech are so limited? Is that a problem for America?
It's not filled out with an awful lot of detail, that critique. Exactly how he is underreached, exactly what it is he should have been doing or saying that he hasn't been doing or saying. But in a speech like that, West Point speech, for example, one part that jumped out at me as being the dues you have to pay in that job is where he says he believes in American exceptionalism.
I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of my being.
Well, that's ridiculous. He certainly doesn't believe in American exceptionalism unless he gets to define it in a way that's very different from the way the users of that phrase generally define it.
Right. When the McCain vetting team was upset to learn that Sarah Palin did not know the phrase American exceptionalism, it wasn't the Obama version of American exceptionalism that they were upset that she didn't know.
That's right.
Another criticism, not just of the speech, and we're, you know, having this conversation as he's in Europe for 4 days, and by the way, those who criticize him as weak, Europe seems to have very much decided that he played his hand well with Ukraine, and they're quite excited to get this gigantic fund for security that he's proposing. But, you know, here in America, one critique is, well, what's the Obama doctrine? And I wonder, does this idea that every president has to have a doctrine, a foreign policy doctrine, was that there when you were working in the White House? And is it a useful thing? And to add a third part to this question, is a doctrine just when a president has a policy, do we call it a doctrine, or is a doctrine something bigger and grander?
Yeah, well, when I was in the White House, yeah, they did want to have a doctrine, and eventually there was a Carter doctrine. It was that any attempt by the Soviet Union to invade or go down to the Persian Gulf was going to be viewed as a threat to the vital interests of the United States and resisted by all means necessary. What a doctrine seems to have come to mean is a threat. The Monroe Doctrine was a threat. The Truman Doctrine was a threat. The Carter Doctrine was a threat. What's the Obama Doctrine? Well, let's not get into any wars that we can't afford, can't win, and don't know how to fight unless we really have to.
One thought I had about the speech. I think that a president needs to be and be seen as proactive. So instead of saying that, you know, my doctrine is not to get in a war, If he could somehow change the lens and say that I have the wisdom doctrine, you know, my doctrine is to proactively seek out the most prudent courses of action, and that often isn't militarism, maybe that would help him. Although maybe that's what he was trying to do, and it just, to his critics, didn't get there.
Well, Mike, I think that if the White House has any sense, you'll be receiving a call soon with a job offer as a speechwriter. If they do it, take it. It's really a fun job.
I hear there's high burnout, but you could pivot to other things like writing for The New Yorker or running a chain of Italian restaurants.
That's right. It's good preparation for a lot of good things.
Rick Herzberg, senior editor and staff writer at The New Yorker. Thanks so much, Rick.
My pleasure, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by our sponsor. Thank you, Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/gist and enter offer code GIST, G-I-S-T, at checkout. The good thing about Squarespace, the reason Squarespace exists, is ease of use. You don't have to know C++. You don't have to know anything except how you want your website to look. And then Squarespace creates easy drag and drop ways to get from head and brain to web. There's 24/7 support through live chat, through email. They're located in New York and Dublin. I mean, who wouldn't want to talk to someone with a brogue about their website? We thank Squarespace for sponsoring The Gist. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website. The Losers Lounge is a long-running cover band, kind of the most ambitious cover band in the world. It was started by Joe McGinty, who, as a session musician, noticed that there were some bands that were fun to play and great to listen to, and people loved them, but they just weren't critical darlings. So he began covering the bands, bands like ABBA and Neil Diamond and Queen, but also Elvis Costello and the Beach Boys. So it became this mix of respected and the semi-disdained. Soon, the Losers Lounge grew. It's been going on for 20 years, sometimes almost two dozen musicians take the stage as they cover different bands. And who they're covering starting this weekend, the Talking Heads. They'll be at Joe's Pub. And Joe McGinty is right here in the studio. Hello, Joe, and thank you for coming in.
Hello.
Why is it called the Losers Lounge?
Well, you know, when I started it, like a lot of things, I wasn't expecting it to go for 20 years. And I'm from Atlantic City originally. And when you're heading down the Atlantic City Expressway towards Atlantic City, every billboard is like Big Winners Club,
yeah,
High Rollers Club. So I thought the Losers Lounge could be like where people that aren't the big winners could hang out. And we're not implying that the people we're honoring are losers. It's more like we're the losers honoring the big winners.
Yeah. That leads to this question. There's this concept, and it comes up a lot in music, guilty pleasure. What do you think of the concept of a musical guilty pleasure?
Well, in a way, I think, you know, that's what started the show. It was a place where you could freely admit to loving ABBA. And when we started, Burt Bacharach hadn't been rediscovered. And I was really surprised because I thought it was me and just like four of my friends that liked Burt Bacharach. But the very first show, all these people came out of the woodwork and were like, hey, this is cool. I can come here and admit that I like these kind of, at the time, cheesy pop songs. And of course, since then, he's been embraced by everybody from Oasis. You know, he's in Austin Powers movies. And,
yeah.
You know, he's been reappreciated. But at the time, it was almost like this little secret society.
But I just think there's been a reclaiming of music that wasn't at the time necessarily the critic's darling as not just, hey, if you like it, you like it, but as actually really good music.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as time goes on, you kind of appreciate it on different terms.
Yeah.
Like you listen to those records and you realize they had like the top arrangers, top producers, session musicians, and, you know, great songwriting. And, you know, when I was a teenager, I wanted to listen to Deep Purple and Alice Cooper. My dad listened to Neil Diamond. So, of course, I was, like, dismissing it. But then when you go and really, and we do that in the show, you know, you dig, really dig deeply into the arrangements and realize how intricate and well thought out they are.
Honey is sweet, but it ain't nothing next to baby's treat. And if you pardon me, I'd like to say we do okay forever in blue jeans.
So the new show, it's all Talking Heads covered. This is not a disdained band. Critics love the Talking Heads. I love the Talking Heads. Do musicians love the Talking Heads?
I think so.
Yeah.
Especially because, you know, they started out like as part of the punk scene, but then they got to a certain point. They brought in all these great musicians like Bernie Worrell, Busta Jones, to kind of enhance their records. So they David Byrne, I guess, had the foresight to take advantage of all these opportunities to work with these cool people. So there's definitely was, you know, I guess an improvement in the sort of musicality of the records, not to take away from the early records, but then suddenly they've got all these amazing players playing with them.
All right. So what I want to know is how you take the Talking Heads and how you turn it into a Loser's Lounge song. What does that sound like? And I know you brought a couple songs, and this is the first of two that we're going to hear by the Loser's Lounge. This is Mariah Carey meets Talking Heads. So tell me about how you, you know, make these songs your own.
Oh, okay. So one of the things we like to do is to kind of mix it up a little bit. You know, Mariah Carey took the Tom Tom Club song Genius of Love and sampled that and built another song. Which is actually multi-leveled because Genius of Love was sampled from a Grandmaster Flash song. So we kind of mixed the Mariah Carey and the Tom Tom Club together and came up with this version with Trisha Scotti singing.
You think Mariah Carey listened to the Talking Heads? It doesn't strike me as the person who had more songs about buildings and food on while she was growing up.
Yeah, it was most likely her engineer or her producer.
But it works. It speaks to, if Mariah Carey can sing it and like it and groove to it, you know, it speaks to universality of the music, for sure.
Right, that, you know, that little riff that they came up with could be appreciated again and again by a different audience.
Have you, in doing a deep dive into one of these bands, come across an arrangement or even, you know, whatever, a short passage that's like shows amazing musicality that's hard for even as good a musician as you and your band members to play to master? Does that happen?
Well, often, you know, in a lot of shows, there's one song. Probably what we always use as our example is Contusion by Stevie Wonder. Contusion is like a really tricky fusion song that he did, like, you know, like crazy fast riffs. There's often a song that will be like, okay, well, this is Contusion for this show. Like another example would be Valerie by the Monkees, you know, total gratuitous pop song, but has this amazing flamenco guitar going all the way through it.
Now, Neil Young, okay, it seems that he would be somewhat antithetical to what you do. There's no guilty pleasure aspect to Neil Young, right? And a lot of his stuff is hard. And it doesn't really seem danceable,
right.
Is it? Do you make it danceable?
Not really, yeah. But there were a couple odd things in his catalog that worked for Loser's Lounge, like Trans, you know, his electronic record. I mean,
Trans is such a tough record. This was the record that he produced because of, you know, he had a severely disabled
son, and he was in a terrible state, and the whole record was like sort of meant not to be listened to. It was just about the inability for him to communicate. I mean, this is one of the toughest records ever to listen to. And you did what with it?
We did a little piece from it.
Oh my God.
And wasn't he sued by his record company?
I think it was also seen as a fuck you to the record company, right? Too. Yeah.
So we like to bring light to, you know, the great songs that these people do, and also maybe some of the bad songs. We maybe give them equal time on our stage.
From Trans to the Dancing Queen to The Smiths and The Cure and everything in between, Joe McGinty is the leader of the Losers Lounge. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I can't seem to face up to the facts. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax. I can't sleep because my bed's on fire. Don't touch me, I'm a real live wire. I'm psycho killer. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
This is Psycho Killer, performed by the Losers Lounge Band. Their next show is a tribute to the Talking Heads. Opens June 5th at Joe's Pub in NYC. And now the spiel. You know, the internet is good for a lot of things. Lightsaber Kid, it put Sam Goody out of business. I didn't like Sam Goody. It took up too much space in the mall, space that could have been used for extra Orange Julius outlets. But the internet is really good for answering, how'd I think of that? In fact, there is one button, the back browser, that's really just a train of thought button. Different tabs, think of them as tangents. But the back browser is the train, and trains go on a track, and you could trace it backwards. It's a vector. So anyway, I was sitting viewing a somewhat remarkable page on the internet, and I said to myself, how in the world did I even get here? And therein lies a story. So the page I'm staring at, asking how, why, a reasonable person might ask, what is wrong with you? What brought you to the California Pot-Bellied Pig Association, specifically an article titled Constipation and Diarrhea in Pot-Bellied Pigs? All right, we're going to trace this back. Let us go back to the start of the journey. It all started right here on this very microphone a few hours ago. I sat here as we recorded the Culture Gab Fest. And as part of the Culture Gab Fest this week, we will be discussing Maleficent, a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty myth. The Sleeping Beauty myth, that has Arne Thompson Classification System 410. What's that? My cohorts Julia and Dana said. What is the Arne Thompson Classification System? And when these two astute and worldly women do not know of something, that thing either does not need to be known, or, as is the case with the Arne Thompson Classification System, it is surely worthy of knowing, and I get the thrill of explaining it. So Antti Aarne was a Finnish folklorist who said all these folk tales, they are so easily categorizable. Just as Linnaeus created a taxonomy of the beasts, so too shall I, Antti Aarne, classify the beasts that bestow wishes or leap for grapes or were once princes. So Aarne put 2,500 folktales in categories, and the list is amazing. Animal tales, the clever fox and other animals. The clever fox is number one in the classification system. Wild animals and domestic animals. That's Arne Thompson Classification System's number 100 through 149. Town mouse and country mouse is part of that. Wild animals and humans. Domestic animals onto supernatural opponents. Supernatural helpers. Rumpelstiltskin is Arne Thompson Classification number 500. Stories about a fool. Jokes about clergymen and religious figures. Arne Thompson Classification System 1725 through 1744. The clergyman is tricked. On and on and on. And then I came across this one. The hog who was so tired of his daily food. Arne Thompson Classification System 211. And I could not find it. I could not find anywhere this story of the hog who was so tired of his daily food. I searched and searched the internet. Why had the hog tired of his daily food? What was wrong with the food? Did the fault lie with our swill or with our swine? What was the moral? Could I apply the moral while each morning I apportioned out Honey Nut Cheerios with a light dusting of Cinnamon Toast Crunch? Every morning. Care for a pancake? No, I'll take Honey Nut Cheerios with 11 Cinnamon Toast Crunches. Great. So I couldn't find the story. But there, as I searched, I saw a result for Chris Christensen. The name was redolent of lore and magic animals. Chris Christensen. So I clicked. No. Chris Christensen and Auntie Arne did not have the folklorist past in common. Chris Christensen might be a folklorist in his spare time or her spare time, but instead, Chris Christensen was the author of these words. Understand, we are not veterinarians. If a veterinarian's advice is available to you, use it. We have over 20 years' experience with pot-bellied pigs, but mostly we have input from hundreds of pot-bellied pig owners across the country and the world. Now, if your pig is diarrhea, you are probably quite aware there is a problem. And I'm going to stop there and not read any more of constipation and diarrhea in pot-bellied pigs. I did a little more searching and I came across an entry, "When the Pig Stops Eating." And I thought, oh, this might be a modern way of stating the title, "The Hog Who Tired of His Daily Food." I clicked on it. Also about pot-bellied pigs with such sentences as, "A healthy pig loves to eat. That is a rule they live by. They should always be ready for the mainstay of their diet, which should be their pig chow." Now, I never in the end learned why the hog got tired of his food. I do not know why Chris Christensen's pigs were constipated. I cannot assure you that everyone lived happily ever after. But I can say that if you wonder why you're staring at pot-belly pig ephemera on the internet, the answer just might have something to do with a folklore classification system invented by a Finn about 100 years ago. And that, my children, is the tale of the constipated hog who lost his way. And that is also it for today's show. Once upon a time, Andrea Salenzi produced Slate's podcasts. Andy Bauer is stuck in his thumb and pulled out the title Executive Producer of Slate Podcasts. You can subscribe in iTunes and give us a review. Please go to iTunes and subscribe specifically to The Gist, though we show up in the Slate Daily Podcast feed. A specific subscription to our show helps us greatly. And get someone else you know who would like it to sign up. You could sign up for our email at slate.com/gist email. Email us directly at thegist@slate.com. And there's one more piece of bonus audio for you for listening all the way through and promising to sign up a friend in iTunes. Here's what happens when former Carter speechwriter Rick Hertzberg's phone rings.
You're quite right about that.
I'm sorry, there's just a...
I'm sorry, that's my phone going off.
Okay, what is that? What song is that?
Remember Obama doing that Al Green?
And then to know that Reverend Al Green was here.
And thanks for listening.